Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is David Ruscio, who is a professor of economics at Notre Dame University. His books include Economic Representations, Both Academic and Everyday, Postmodern Moments in Modern Economics, and his latest, Rethinking Planning, Development, and Globalization, Essays in Marxian Class Analysis. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Ruscio.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be back.
And you're just back from Europe. You're in Italy, where there were riots. Of course, the Occupy Wall Street movement has spread across this country, but it also seems to have inspired movements across the world. In Spain, hundreds of thousands gathered to occupy the streets and protests. And in Italy, there was some violence. So what was your takeaway?
I mean, in all honesty, I think we're all a bit surprised about how quickly this has emerged and spread, as you say, across the United States and around the world. Here in the United States, one of the things that amazes me is in large cities where perhaps one might expect it, New York and Los Angeles, Boston, Washington, D.C., but also in small towns, including my own hometown in Connecticut, where it's the last thing I would have expected. They had an Occupy movement this past weekend. And as you say, of course, in Europe. One of the interesting things about the Occupy movement, or as it's known in Europe, the movement of the outrage or the angry, the indignati, is that, you know, they tie their own sense of history. They have a sense of history. They tie it back to the Arab Spring. They tie it back to the earlier protest movements in Spain, and they see themselves as part of that. And I think that's one of the reasons why, in reverse, it has spread in solidarity around the world. We now have hundreds of cities in the United States where there are occupations taking place, including here in Chicago, where I'm speaking from right now, and as you say, around the world. Here's one of the things that I find interesting, is that Rome, this past weekend, is the only city where there has been significant violence on the part of the protesters. We know, of course, that there's been violence on the part of the police. And even there, it's been relatively muted, you know, except for perhaps one might call them idiots in New York City. The problem in Italy is that the movement started, like everywhere else, as a protest movement, as a nonviolent protest movement, and then it was hijacked. And it's the only place where it was hijacked by a very small but belligerent and violent group of some combination of delinquents and extremists. But I think it tells us, precisely because in Italy they got so much publicity, that around the world it's pretty amazing that it has not happened, and I'm very pleased by that. I think it says something about the political maturity of this movement.
And David Ruscio, do you think that the political maturity will be maintained? I mean, there's been infiltrations from right-wing provocateurs like this right-wing hit guy O'Keefe and others. Breitbart and others are trying to find ways to discredit the movement. But it seems to me that as long as this movement focuses on economic issues, which is central, and I think the framing of the 99% versus the 1% is a very powerful message, and polls indicate that there's tremendous public support for the movement so far, far overshadowing support for the Tea Party. So what's your sense of it, since it's on the left? Is there any possibility that it could be diffused by identity politics and single-issue protests?
Listen, I mean, these things are always in danger. I mean, you know, this is a movement which is only a couple of months old. It is still in that way in its infancy in terms of lots of people who have not been particularly involved in politics. I mean, in other countries, one always expects these things to be generated by established political parties. That's not the case in the United States, and I think much to its credit. And I think there will be lots of difficult moments ahead. In fact, again, I'm amazed that there have not been so many thus far.
The reason I asked that question was you mentioned how in Italy the anarchists hijacked the protests and they got a lot of publicity at the expense of the 99% of peaceful protesters.
Yes, it happened, and yet I don't think that's going to ruin the movement in Italy. I think it's made the occupiers, the occupards, if we want to call them that, more aware of that possibility. And I think more safeguards will be taken in the future that that does not happen. It need not follow, for example, the protests in Seattle, in Genoa, and elsewhere, as we know, the anti-globalization protests that turned violent pretty quickly, in part because a small minority of protesters set out to do that. That does not seem to be the case right now. For me, the danger is less that, at least thus far, and less the infiltration from the right wing, although both of those things are happening.
Again, I'm speaking with David Ruscio, who is a professor of economics at Notre Dame University and the author of Rethinking Planning, Development, and Globalization, Essays in Marxian Class Analysis. And the stark message of the 99% versus the 1% has traction in the country, and I guess in a way it's gratifying that since we've had this kind of creeping oligarchy and this corporate plutonomy who've essentially sewn up the political power and control the economy, it's gratifying in a way that much of the mythology that we always thought about that America stood for, an egalitarian society with a meritocracy, it's not entirely dead. The fact that 67% of the public support the Occupy Wall Street movement would indicate that in spite of this general sense of worshipping the rich and the Tea Party being an astroturf organization paid for by the Kochs, the fact is, I suppose, we can take heart in the fact that the American people aren't buying it.
No, I don't think they are. And I think there is, in fact, general support. Right? And we know that there's general support from the statistics, from the polls that have been done. And I'll tell you, from the streets of Chicago, at the corner where the protests are taking place here in Chicago, which happens to be at the Board of Trade, the Federal Reserve, and the headquarters of the Bank of America, talk about symbolic, the people who pass by, from taxi drivers to tourists on double-decker buses, are honking and cheering in support of the protesters. The protest right now is, in that sense, clean. Everyone understands. I don't think this was this. No one could have dreamt of this. This emerged from the movement itself, this idea of the 99%, and it is brilliant. It is a way of capturing the idea that it is, in fact, the top 1% of the U.S. population and an even smaller percentage of the world population that control an extraordinary amount of the income and wealth. In the United States, for example, total income in 2008 to the top 1% was about 18%. Wealth distribution is even worse. I just happened today to be looking at a new report by Credit Suisse that calculates world wealth. And what they find is that one half of 1% of households in the world control about 40% of the world's wealth. It's that extraordinary concentration of income and wealth, and therefore, of course, power at the top, that I think people understand was both a cause of the current crises and is preventing an effective resolution. That is, there has been no recovery. There's certainly been no recovery for the 99%, and I think people understand that. I think that's why the movement has so much support.
And how do you think this will translate into electoral politics? Because the constellation seems to be fairly much in favor of the Republicans, and the Koch brothers clearly are the kind of poster boys for the 1% for America's oligarchs, and they're quite determined to get their way, and they actually, along with Karl Rove and Dick Armey, have managed to turn this AstroTurf Tea Party movement into electoral politics in an extremely effective way. They got over 60 members elected to the House of Representatives. They've changed the national agenda. They've almost shut down the government. They forced the president to capitulate on a hostage crisis where the entire national economy was held hostage in order to get their way. So there's an example on the right, and let's face it, no president since Roosevelt's been reelected with a 9% unemployment, and it's likely to be even worse by the time November 2012 gets around. There's an awful lot of Democratic seats open in the Senate that would indicate the Republicans have a good chance. In general, I sense that, you know, the old adage from the Clinton administration, it's the economy, stupid, will be the deciding factor in 2012. What's going to change that?
Well, I think you're right. I think it is the economy. I think there's no doubt about that. When 26 million people in the United States are either employed or unemployed, then we're talking about over 16% of the labor force in the United States, which in all of its ramifications on people's economic security, on their health, on sending their kids to college, and so on and so forth, that's a disaster. And people are, I think, angry. I think part of that anger, I think in its first stage, took the form of the Tea Party. And as you say, the Tea Party had tremendous success, had success in the media, and, of course, had success in electing members of Congress. The Obama administration, especially the Obama administration's economic team, has been much less effective for a variety of reasons, and we could go into those. In that sense, Obama and company don't deserve to be reelected. On the other hand, if one listens to the economic messages of the current Republican candidates and of the cheering of the crowds during the course of the debates, when, for example, Herman Cain blames the unemployed for their own plight and the crowd cheers, that's not a message that the majority of the population are going to buy. When you look at their economic proposals, which are only to decrease even further regulations on corporations, to decrease even further taxes on large corporations and on wealthy individuals, that's not a message that's going to expand or attract any attention over the course of the next 12 months. One never knows in politics when you have an angry population, and one that is, as I see it, is rightfully angry. On the other hand, I think the Tea Party and company have, as they say, maxed out. I think they had their day in the sun. I think they grew. I think they were successful. And I don't think it's going anywhere beyond that. So I think the onus now shifts to the movement of the 99%. I think the onus now shifts to the Occupy movement. And that's where I think we'll see, far-reaching political implications over the course of the next 12 months.
But there's no such analogy here, David Ruscio, in the sense that the Tea Party was a repackaging of the Republican right wing, and it was essentially done to elect candidates. It was directly translated into electoral politics. The Occupy Wall Street movement, excuse me, does not have any political aspirations at this point, but particularly in electoral politics. They're very wary of the Democrats. They're wary of being co-opted. So my question is how who does the messaging in terms of this election? If the White House and the Democrats can't find a message, it seems to me that there's some pretty clear messages out. One, the 99% versus the 1%. And two, what seems to be pretty clear to me, and at the risk of being cynical, I'm pretty convinced that this is what's going on. And there's a bumper sticker out there to this effect that the Republicans are determined to keep millions of Americans out of work so that one man loses his job.
Well, I think there's no doubt about that. That's what their plan is. The question is, does it work? And I think people are not buying that now, at least according to the opinion polls. The Republican Congress and the Tea Party have, in fact, lost a great deal of their support. What is interesting about the Occupy movement is precisely that it cannot be contained within mainstream electoral politics. Its demands are more far-reaching, and that's what makes it interesting. Here in the United States, we often go through this four-year cycle, and then people get revved up, and then there's a presidential election, and nothing happens, or certainly nothing happens according to their elevated expectations. I think this time around, the demand is to go beyond that. And there's no doubt that the people involved in it are going to engage in electoral politics as individuals, as part of other groups, but not as the Occupy movement. And I think the Occupy movement loses its own depth if, in fact, it succumbs to this four-year presidential political cycle in the United States.
Well, what do you think, though? The choice here is, or the way the battle lines are drawn at this point, and obviously it's early, but it seems that based upon what happened in 2010, based upon the dismal economy and the inability to do anything about it, the conventional wisdom would be that people aren't that sophisticated in their choices. They're just angry, and they kick the incumbents out. The only thing that would change that, I think, given the failure of the White House in terms of messaging and in terms of their attempt at stimulus, which a lot of economists thought was too little and too much sort of shovel-ready, crude Keynesianism and not anything imaginative in terms of...
No doubt about that.
No, well, exactly. So, do you think... And we're not talking about the 99% the Occupy Wall Street movement being in any way co-opted. I'm just they're out there with a sort of parallel message. Is it going to be a case of the people determining the outcome of this election and not the politicians?
Listen, as always a combination of those two things. Often we make the comparison between the crisis that erupted in 2007-2008 and the Great Depression. And I often remind people that one of the big differences between the policies then and now, between, if you will, FDR and Obama, is that FDR faced a strong mass-based movement on the left, made up of political parties, made up of trade unions, and so on and so forth. That has not existed until now in the United States, but it now exists. That's what the Occupy movement represents. If Obama and company have any sense of what is going on politically in this country, then they sense that challenge from the left. That is what this Occupy movement represents. It will then respond to that. If they don't, then they don't, and they don't deserve to be reelected. My sense, however, is that the attraction of the Tea Party movement and of the right wing, as I said before, I think has peaked, and I think is declining right now. I think the individuals who are part of the 99% will, in fact, rightfully or wrongfully, vote for Obama because there is no other alternative at this particular point. But here's what I think is interesting, right? So I'm not in the business of making predictions. But it's pretty clear that none of these Republican candidates has been able to capture and respond to the economic discontent in this country that people experience. The absence of political democracy and the absence of economic democracy and, of course, of economic and political justice. To that extent that they can't respond to that, then they don't win. Obama then wins by default. What is interesting, I think, about the Occupy movement is that it transcends Obama, so that even if Obama wins, this movement doesn't stand down. It doesn't take that as a victory. It takes that as that which is possible in the moment, but what is necessary to do goes far beyond electing one or another candidate. That's what I think is particularly interesting and that we have to be open to as time goes on.
Well, David Russia, I thank you so much for joining us here and for your new book, Rethinking Planning, Development, and Globalization, Essays in Marxian Class Analysis.
I appreciate the opportunity. It's always, once again, a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with David Ruzzio, who is professor of economics at Notre Dame University. His books include Economic Representations, Both Academic and Everyday, Postmodern Moments in Modern Economics, and his latest, Rethinking Planning, Development, and Globalization, Essays in Marxian Class Analysis. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Chris Payne, the co-writer and director of the new documentary feature film, Revenge of the Electric Car.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.